Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise
high as the
Ashe.
Ashe.
We'll pour to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge. Ashe.
Ashe. Ashe.
We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science. Ashe.
Ashe. Ashe.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who, finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places, learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God, oh Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here, buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with the Dinka symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe. Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, stop, no more. We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths. We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names. Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, Muhammad,
John Henry Clark, John Dr. G. Jackson, Muhammad. Jacob Carruthers.
Malcolm X.
And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name. Ashe.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
I'd like to do a poem called Billy Green is Dead, and what it does is point out our concern is still rather shallow. Community-mindedness, our community orientation toward each other is still not what it should be. This is called Billy Green is Dead.
The economy's in an uproar. The whole damn country's in the red. Taxi fares are going up. You say Billy Green is dead. The government can't decide on busing, or at least that's what they said. Yeah, I heard you when you told me, you said Billy Green was dead. But let me tell you about these hot pants that this big leg sister wore when I parted with the alphas. What? Billy took an overdose. Well, now, junkies will be junkies. But did you see Gunsmoke last night? Man, they had themselves a shootout and folks was dying left and right. At the end, when Matt was cornered, I had damn near give up hope. Why you keep on interrupting me? You say, my son is taking dope. Call a law and call a doctor. What you mean I shouldn't scream? My only son is taking dope. Should I sit here like I'm pleased? Is that familiar, anybody? Check out what's inside your head, because it never seems to matter when it's Billy Green who's dead.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Greetings and Hotep, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here every Tuesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. East Central Time, 8 to 10 Eastern. So happy that you have decided to be with us this afternoon, this evening. Have a very dynamic program. We're going to talk about brothers and working in the streets and in the community, and that those things that we must continue to do. And we want to kind of look at how to galvanize ourselves and make that happen. We really appreciate you, as I said earlier. This is the timeforanawakening.com radio network. It is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network. And we are here, as I said, every Tuesday evening. There are other programs that are a part of this system as well. We'll talk about those at the top of the hour. Also want to talk about some of the other programs that are a part of the Black Reality Think Tank radio network, and to kind of give you an idea of some of the upcoming discussions that we will be having here. We are about the community. We are community-minded. We are an empowerment platform. We give each other an opportunity to talk, to express ourselves, to give our ideas so that we can build the proper agendas for our people and our children to have and move forward. And so that is our goal. That is our purpose here. We've been doing this now for about 5 or 6 years, and we're really happy. I have a very good brother that's going to be coming and joining us. I'm going to introduce in just a few minutes. He's not only a good brother, he's a good friend. Known each other for a very long time, had a chance to work with each other in some of the community activities that he and I both have been involved in. And so we want to introduce him. And then, as I said, we're going to talk about black men. We're calling the brothers together here and asking them to join us and to join those. And this is not one of those programs where we are going to criticize people for not working and not participating in that community and not doing it. Because there are a lot of people working in our community. There are a lot of people doing some great things. And there are a lot of people doing some things of empowerment. But what we are asking is for more people to join them so that they can be successful and can be doing that. And so we want to talk about that, how to do that, who are some of the people that have that we speak of, both not only locally but nationally as well. And it's going to give us an opportunity to see how we can bring other folks to the table in the building process. We have a long way to go. We've got a lot that we have to do for our families and our children, and we want to do that as productively as possible. And so that is what we are discussing today, and I'm so appreciative that you have chosen to join us. As you know, we always do an ancestral profile. We always like to thank our ancestors for what they've done and the role that they played. We stand on their shoulders. We stand on their shoulders of greatness. So we really appreciate being able to use this particular time to highlight. So I've decided to do something just a little bit different. We are going to, this is an ancestral profile, but it's actually a profile of the work and the vision of the ancestor. Particular, and this is a part of a book that this particular ancestor had written years ago, very familiar to all of you. And I just want to take an excerpt of this particular passage because it is so relevant to what we are talking about tonight, and talking about the black male and the necessity of them being able to come into the community and pick up the mantle and continue to do the work that our ancestors did. And so we're going to be taking a look at a quote from a favorite of mine, the great James Baldwin. And it's from his book, The Fire Next Time. And it says, he's writing this letter to his nephew. And it's very powerful. And this is what he says. He said, I know what the world has done to my brother and how narrowly he has survived it. And I know which is much worse. And this is the crime of which I accuse my country and my countrymen, for which neither I nor time nor history will ever forgive them, that they have destroyed and are destroying hundreds of thousands of lives and do not know it and do not want to know it. One can be, indeed, one must strive to become tough and philosophical concerning destruction and death, for this is what most of mankind has been best at since we have heard of man. But remember, most of mankind is not all of mankind, but it is not permissible that the authors of devastation would also be innocent. It is the innocent which constitutes the crime. The innocent country set you down in a ghetto in which, in fact, it intended that you should perish. Let me spell out precisely what I meant by that. For the heart of the matter is here and the root of my dispute with my country. You were born where you were born and faced the future that you faced because you were black and for no other reasons. The limits of your ambition were thus expected to be set forever. You were born into a society which spelled out with brutal clarity and in as many ways as possible that you are a worthless human being. You were not expected to aspire to excellence. You were not expected to make peace with mediocrity. Wherever you have turned, James, in your short time on this earth, you have been told where you could go and what you could do and how you could do it and where you could live and whom you could live and marry. I know your countrymen do not agree with me about this, and I hear them saying, you exaggerate, but they do not know Harlem, and I do. So do you. Take no one's word for anything, including mine, but trust your experience. Know whence you came. If you know whence you came, there is really no limit to where you can go. The details and symbols of your life have been deliberately constructed to make you believe what white people say about you. Please try to remember that what they believe, as well as what they do and can and cause you to do, does not testify to your inferiority, but to their inhumanity and fear. James Baldwin, The Fire Next Time. Okay, we are going to get ready for our discussion as we talk about our brothers. We not only must look at contemporary brothers, we must look at those brothers coming behind us. And we're going to make this kind of a little open discussion. I see that there are several of our community panel that have always participated here online, and I appreciate them for joining that. Brother Timothy, Philadelphia, Brother Otis Griffin, out of Newport News, my buddy, Dr. Bruce Bridges, Brother Herbie White. So we're going to have a good conversation about black male activism. And how to get more brothers to the table. And it's like we had Brother Tony Courtney, who was a member of the Milwaukee community, has this thing said, old school, we ain't through yet. And that's exactly right. We're not through yet. I know I'm old school, but we're not through. Got some work to do. I got grandkids I look at, and I watch them trying to survive and do what they need to do. They vary in age. I've got a grandchild that's close to 40. I've got right down the ladder, all the way down to one that's a year, not even a year yet. I've got a great, great grandchild, and I'm watching them. I'm watching them all trying to grapple with life. I'm watching their parents as they attempting to try to raise them, and particularly now in this midst of this COVID-19 unemployment, poverty, community harassment, community death. You know, it's just a lot that we have to do. And we just can't take it for granted that it's going to just change. We're going to have to change it. And that's what we're talking about today. I want to talk about how to do that. So with that, I have a very dear good friend. So happy that he agreed to come on. He never hesitated when I called to ask him. He is the founder and the executive of director of a program called We Got This. I love it. Love that title. It's called We Got This. And he has been so many other wonderful things. First of all, he's a very artistic brother. He's a thespian. He was at one time I had the pleasure of serving on the board of directors of the only black theater company in Milwaukee called Hansberry Sands. And at that time, he was the creative director of the Hansberry Sands at the point. So I had a chance to work with him in that venue and produce plays for our community and encourage our community through theater. He's done a magnificent job with that. He's also, I've watched him, for instance, there's several brothers that are doing other things. He's always been a support to everybody else. There's this annual event that's held every year in Milwaukee called the Father's Picnic. And what happens is that all of the young men, brothers of the community, come together in one of the local parks here, and they get a chance to meet with each other. Everything is free, the food. They get haircuts, they get medical tests, all kind of things is done. And that is run by a beautiful brother in our community named Brother Charlie, is what we call him. And I watched Andre sort of orchestrate that, as well as MC for a lot of the programs. And I can go on and on about the stuff that my brother has done. But anyway, I want to bring him on because he's truly been one that has been active, and he's still active. He's old school, but he ain't through yet. And so with that, I want to bring on to you my dear friend, Brother Andre D. Ellis. Good afternoon, my good brother. Oh, I'm sorry, Andre. I had your mic mute. I'm sorry.
Can you hear me now?
Now I got you, my brother. How you doing? How you doing?
Man, I'm excited to be alive, and what a day to be alive while all of this is going on. And just greetings to you and to all of the listening audience and everybody that is there, especially those that have come before me that are still alive and are listening and getting ready to get involved in this discussion. I hope that respectfully and honorably I can say something and lend something to the conversation to show that we're still pushing. Right. We ain't through yet.
That's right. We're not through. No, we got work to do. And most of the brothers I know and most of the ones that are online here now that I know are still out there. They on the battlefield, and they still doing what they need to do. So, Andre, how do we get some of the brothers that are not yet out here with us? How do we go after them? I know you started doing it with the young ones. You had how many young men were you working with in that We Got This?
Well, you know, we started with one young man that was in trouble with the police. That's how the program started. And his mother came to my door. And with that, we went to the 5th District Police Station and just encouraged them to not arrest this 11-year-old boy 8 years ago and to release them to me. And I sort of made up a little story. There was a vacant lot next to the house that I lived in. And then I said that we were going to be starting a program where he would be coming and learning how to grow food and feed the community. And we would teach him to clean up and that we would pay him a small stipend to do that work. And from there, we started with him. And by the end of the summer, the first year, we had over 100 young black men, ages 12 to 16 years old, that would gather in this garden on Saturday morning at 8 o'clock. And they have to be on time. 8:00.1 is late. It's been 8 years, and I've never let anybody late in after 8:00.1. In fact, 100 boys, 80 or 60, are always there before that time because they want to be involved. And we have men from the community that come in and mentor these young men. And that's one way that I try to encourage getting the men in the community involved.
Get them involved. Right. Exactly. That's beautiful. You know, I don't know. I've never had a chance to talk to you about this, but one of my grandsons was a member of your group. His name was Christopher Washington. And
yeah,
Yeah, Chris was a, remember. I remember that, and he was telling us about the abilities of what he had to do and make sure he was on time and had to do this and had to do that. So, I witnessed, you know, the value of that program. And then at the end of the toward the fall, you had a big event where they wore tuxedos. Tell us about that deal with those tuxedos, and they got together and dressed up.
There was a time when one of the young men saw me and my wife dressed up to go to dinner and wanted to know why they couldn't dress up and go to dinner. And so I had to develop what was called the Black Tux 5, the 100 Black Tuxedo event at that time, where we asked the men of the community to rent tuxedos for the young men to wear and mentor and accompany them to dinner at a place, a fine establishment in the city where they necessarily you didn't see African-American men gather. It ended up becoming the 500 Black Tuxedos just the next year after that. Right. We haven't had it for a little over a couple years now. The pandemic had stopped it this year, but we're going to get back to it. But that's where young Black men dressed up in tuxedos. The older men helped them learn how to tie a tie, etiquette, things like that, and they just learn how to be brilliant and that they can dress up and go and eat anywhere that they choose.
Right, right, exactly. And we know that it works. We know the results of those activities work because, you know, for instance, when Brother Philip Scott, who was at the time the head of the mentoring department for the OIC, Opportunities Industrial Centers of Greater Milwaukee. And he and right. Dr. Battle were there, and they hired me to do training for the mentors. And our job was, and we had Brother Andre would go out and try to recruit men to join and become mentors and work with the numbers, the hundreds of kids that were a part of the OIC program where parents, a lot of them were single mothers who were trying to raise these boys. And so as a result of that, they wanted them to be mentored. And, you know, we did that with Andre and Philip Scott. And then, you know, the earlier years where you even used to work with us with the 100 Black Men of Milwaukee, and people like Oshie and James Hall and myself and Ken Little, and I can just go on and on. These were brothers that would given their time and their resources out here to try to get together and mentor these boys. So we know it works, but the problem always is, like it always has been, is being able to get the mentors and get them to be consistent. So let me ask this then, Andre. What do you see now as the 2020 now, talking 2020, what do you see as the greatest obstacle for getting more people to the table? To help, even if they have to start their own stuff. And now with COVID and all the things that we've got, we can't stop. You know, I don't know what else can I say. We cannot stop. What do you see as a possibility of being able to get this thing continuing without difficulties and challenges? What is a way that you would think needs to happen?
One thing that pushed me for real, Dr. Rogers, is a couple of years ago, maybe 4 years ago, our program's been going about 8 years now. And I remember when Brother Muhib Dyer and Brother Quabana Antoine Nixon, who are powerful young men that work with the I Will Not Die Young program here in Milwaukee. And we had 100 Black boys, ages 12 to 16 in the garden, who had gotten there at 8 o'clock to work for that $20 stipend. And I asked the question, how many of you don't know your dad? Out of 190 boys raised their hand. Mm-hmm. Then I asked the question, how many of you know your dad but still don't have a relationship with him? Another five. Mm-hmm. Out of 100 little Black boys ages 12 to 16 who had gotten to the garden by 8 o'clock to work and do something honest to make a living for $20 for that day, only five of them possibly knew their dad and had a relationship with him. It was at that time that I told them, I may not be your birth dad, but I am the earth dad.
Right.
And you come to this garden whenever you have a problem and anything that it is, we can fix it. But I also can tell you that most time that I make the call and ask Black men in Milwaukee to come forth mm-hmm. and work with me in this program, they do come.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a need for more Most definitely. We've got some drastic things going on.
Right.
We've got some things that we need to tackle immediately. It's a little violent here. Every night, every day that we're waking up now, we're finding that there's some tragedy in our neighborhood, so much so that I'm concerned, because now a lot of it is that you're seeing and hearing about the women starting to get shot, and they're getting younger and younger. And not only are the ones that are dying getting younger, but the ones that are killing them are getting younger. So two families are losing. The family that has someone that goes to jail that's 17, 16, or 18 years old and is facing life and possibly could get it, but also the ones that die as a result of it. So we definitely need to do more to get more men to come forward. I believe that when black men begin to come forward, that's when we have change happen. History shows that, too. And you just spoke on it with all of the different programs. I believe Mr. Scott's program was the From Boys to Men program.
That's right.
What it was called.
That's right. It was.
And Andre Sherrard, so that we can make it clear, because my name's Andre, too, and he was a very good friend of mine, and rest in peace, good brother, who taught a lot of those young boys how to wear a suit, mm-hmm. how to tie a tie,
right.
long before I even, or we even started our program. But I do, and we'll stand on that,
right.
that, and I'm hoping my brothers that are listening, because we got some powerful, strong, young and older black men here, but there are more that need to come out of hiding, that need to come out of the house, need to come out of the church, need to come out of City Hall, need to come out of the state capitol, need to come out of their businesses, wherever it is, and they need to come into the streets, and we need to grab our young brothers by the hand, and we need to say to them, you will do better. This is not it. This will not be our end. This will not be our history.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And we see that. Those who are in the streets working, you see that these young brothers respond to that. I mean, and it's very clear. You have to do the knuckle work. You have to get down into the bottom line. I remember we were doing the mentoring program at Dr. Martin Luther King School, which was in King Drive, in the middle of the hood, the middle of it, and we had to teach those young men how to take a shower. They didn't know how to take a shower. We said, I remember one time,
just hygiene all around, Dr.
All
Rogers.
Around, yeah. They could not do that. They did not know that. I said, when you take a shower, where you wash? And they say, wash under their arm. They say, right their hair, face. I said, what about down there at the bottom? Huh?
Yes.
I said, down at the bottom.
Yes.
That get dirty down there. And so, you know, just things like that is very clearly, you know.
But, you know, our young black men go through a lot. A lot of them are afraid to touch themselves because in a lot of cases somebody has already touched them, and so they're embarrassed about it. And they don't want to go there. But mm-hmm. I can tell you this, there's a word that I use that usually reaches deep into the heart of the young men that I meet, and some of the most troubled, the most meanest, and most hardest characters, when I put a hand on the shoulder and I say, son, it breaks them down. And a lot of them have told me it's because they've been longing for that, or nobody never called them that.
Right.
Sometimes they don't know what to do with that because they never met a dad.
Exactly.
Or they didn't. Or when they did meet dad, he rejected them. Things like that, man. It's just,
and that's
just
what
really
we're working
deep.
With. That's what we're working with. You're right.
And it's hardcore. But a lot of them long to be better than they are.
Yes.
A lot of them long to be better than the dad that they didn't have. And the presence of men, even if it's not their dad, allows them to say, hey, I can become a man that can become a father either to my own and possibly to some others, because that just may be what it has to be. If you're a good man, you may have to adopt on your own in your soul and spirit the friends and the kids in your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And we got to create our own programs. Right on the block where I live, I have a little saying that I use in the garden. I say, on the block where I live, I am the change that needs to be.
Right.
On the block where I live, I'm helping to make the changes that the people need to see on the block where I live.
Exactly.
We clean up the streets. Right. We used to be on 9th and Ring Street in Milwaukee. When we first started this program 8 years ago, we were known as in the top five of the worst blocks, highest crime blocks in the city of Milwaukee, in the state of Wisconsin. It took us 2 years, and we came off of that list. And I said to the boys, how many of you all know that you can go from being number one and go backwards and then become number one again? And a lot of them didn't get it. But I told them sometimes you got to take it backwards to correct it. But we got to begin to have faith in our young black men, because a lot of them are brilliant. Some of them just never had anybody call them son. So a lot of them are smart. They just never had anybody call them son. A lot of them aren't committing crime. They just never had anybody call them son. And we got to bring those young men forth. And I think by bringing those young men forth, they'll get more men to come forth. This is not funny, but a young man made a joke, and he cracked up laughing at this. And I almost was in tears when he said this to me. He said he tried to make a joke, and I invited him to the microphone. I didn't know he was going to say this. And he said, "Mr. Andre, you want to know why black men don't come to the garden sometimes?" And I said, "Why not?" He said, "Because they might meet their son."
Hmm. Oh, that's true. That's exactly
That's right. How quiet the garden became, except for the young men that were laughing. And I know an embarrassing laugh when I hear it. Okay. So I'm not going to knock or put down my brothers. I'm going to continue to try to be a sample and an example and continue to call them forth, doing things that call them forth, merging and working together with other organizations here. Because I think that's one of the problems, too. We operate too much in silos, and we need to hub some of this. Right. We need to not be afraid to bring all of our stuff under one umbrella, under another capital group, to institutionalize in a positive way what we do. I think we'll have more support. We'll be stronger in numbers. Even if we individually operate in the spaces that we do, when do we come together, meet up, set the agenda, and decide how we will proceed, how we will make life better in the city, and how we will present and gather our own statistics and stop waiting for other people to define who we are? And we don't have to ask for permission anymore, because we are here, and really we do got this more than we know.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I remember when the Welfare to Work program, which was called the W-2 program, started. We had an opportunity. I was asked to be a part of a group that were doing focus group studies with the men who were not taking care of their kids. And I remember, it was all men, and I remember asking them together, "Why don't you take care of your children? Why is it that you are not supporting and helping their mother take care of them?" And their response was the majority of it, because I would have them write it down first before they verbally did it, because I didn't want anybody following anybody else's idea. And I said, "Write it down first, and then we'll go around the table and read it." The biggest one, if there were 12 people at the table, 9 of them said, "Because she got somebody else, let them do it. She got another man, let them do it." I said, "But the other man, not their kids. That's not his kid. You the daddy." "Well, I've tried to come up there and help him, and he always up in there. I ain't going up in there where he is," and boom, 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 just all kinds of things. So the focus group was designed to see if we could get to the gut butt truth, as Alderman McGee used to see, the butt naked truth, and find out how do we stir you, how do we get you. And then that was the question: that what will help you to get back and do for your children? You, not your wife, and leave her out. Leave the mother out. What would it take to get you? And then that response, you just said, "I need a job, and then I can do it," because most of them were unemployed. And so I think those kinds of conversations have to continue, but at the same time, it has to be a system where you can show. They have to be shown what fatherhood is, because a lot of them haven't had fathers. A lot of the fathers of the fathers
it's generational.
And so, right. So there has to be some kind of image of what a father is and what a father does. And first of all, it's not an easy job. It's not a glorious job. And anybody who's listening to this, who is a father, you know what I'm talking about. But at the same token, you have a responsibility. You have a God-given responsibility to take care of that child. And we gotta continue to move that forward. One of the things, Brother Andre, I wanted to ask you about, I know you were doing that gardening thing that you had them growing vegetables and plants. I thought that was powerful. What was the benefit of that? What did you see happening out of them getting involved into that type of activity?
Well, the garden is still going, and even to this date, just today we had food giveaway where the Running Rebels donated free food, and we give it away. But the good thing about the garden is that it gave them a hub. It gave them a gathering place that they could come when they left home, and they could come and they could meet up with other men, men that look like them, men that they wish were in the house with them, and they could learn how to grow their own food. Because one of the things that I've learned from working with growing the food is that the processed food that we get in the store doesn't always work with our DNA. But the food that we grow in good soil, that we nurture ourselves, they take great pride in. Some of them had never tasted a cucumber straight out of the soil. And I often said to them, put your hand in the soil and don't move. Now look up at the sky. Now I want you to keep your hands in the soil and try to put it on the trigger of a gun. They couldn't do it. And I saw, and I would say to them, as long as your hands are in the soil, you don't have to put them on the trigger of a gun. When this food grows, you can eat it. You can take it home to your parents. They can eat it. You can take it to your neighbors. And there's so much land right in your own backyard where you can grow this food. Many of them would come and say, hey, I took the idea of growing carrots and cucumbers home, and we started growing it in the living room. Then I transplanted it into the backyard, and they took great pride. And when I told them that you could take cucumbers and make cucumber water, you could become a water salesman. You can take lemon and make lemonade and stand right here on the corner, and for $1 or $2 a cup, you could sell 1,000 people a cup, and you can make $1,000 or $2,000 growing your own food. What it did was teaching them the benefits of owning and owning themselves.
Right.
Owning the land. When you own the land, they have to ask for permission to come over. But as long as you're leasing or you don't have any ownership, you have to. They can come over whenever they want to.
Right, exactly. You know, I was really proud when Steve Harvey had you on his program and he gave you that award. That was excellent. I think that somehow or the other I saw it that boost you to even continue to do more stuff. I remember right after that, you really turned the heat up at that point and really began to do it. And that's good because you need sometimes that boost. You need that financial support to get these things working.
Well, you know, Dr. Rogers, the boys saw that. They saw themselves. They saw the other young men that went with me. There were more young men in the back that couldn't come out. We took a whole busload, but they couldn't all come on stage. But it made them feel like somebody was watching them. Somebody saw them. They got dressed up for that program, and they were recognized. It was, and that happened after one Saturday we were working, and I had about 64 young men working, and we were cleaning the streets. And I remember I was picked out picking up trash, and I heard a voice behind me say, hey, what are you guys cleaning up, bullets? And when I looked back, it was a Milwaukee police officer. I became irate, and I charged him, and I did. I disrespected him as well. I even went over to the 5th District station and asked the liaison officer to please remove him from the street and not allow him to come back over there anymore. That was so disrespectful, and the young men were so upset. It took me a moment to calm them down, and I said to them, we will be recognized for the work that we do. Just stay in order, and let's keep cleaning up our neighborhood and keep on working.
Exactly.
And it happened, Dr. Rogers.
Exactly.
And that gave them a boost. And now a lot of those young men are in college.
Okay.
I could name a few of them that have graduated college. I could name some of them that are great fathers, some of them that are working, that have started their own businesses, that are entrepreneurs. It was hard for me to know every one of them individually. But young men come to me all the time and say, it was coming through, we got this, and that program that gave me pride in myself. And when you talked about reading, and you talked about Langston Hughes, and you talked about other great black men, and you talked the stories of your grandfather and how he told the story, it made me feel good as a black man. And I wanted to break the generational curse of not being one of the men that would not take care of the children. So I've got a baby now, and I keep my son. Even though me and the mother isn't together, I respect her. She's got another guy, but I don't have anything to do with that. And I go get my son, because if my son or daughter is with me, I don't have to worry about what he's doing with them.
Right. Okay. All right. Let me ask this. In light of all of what you said, and as you have obviously given our audience an opportunity to see the the value of your work and what you're doing, and how you've attempted to reach out to other brothers to participate and to give of their time and essence to it. And you've done a magnificent job of all of that. But black kids are still killing each other at large numbers. How would you respond to that?
As long as families don't have the resources in the house, we're going to have the bloodshed in the streets. And I think in a lot of cases, it's by design. You know, Milwaukee, Wisconsin have a lot of incarceration of young and old black men. They're ready to put them in jail, but they have to go through hell if they want to start their own business. And they have to be extremely determined, and they have to be extremely humble sometimes. And I have to teach them that you don't have to cuss or fuss, just that you have to know that there's a must in what you want to do. The way that I respond to it is that we have to continue to come down on our governments and demand from them those resources that we need in the house, where you have working parents that pay taxes too, that are going out to all of the other communities outside of us. It's very difficult when you're hungry. Right. It's very difficult when your heat is off. It's very difficult when you have mental illness that's untreated in the house. You know, drugs and alcohol is prevalent in our communities. So we have to begin to attack those devilish things that try to deter our children to want to be that way and think the only way that they can make money is by carrying a gun, by dealing drugs, things like that. We have to get them to use a lot of their creative energy and learn how spiritual they are and how that can take them a long way, if hoping that answers your question.
Yeah, that does. It does. And I mean, it's something that you hear people say, and even in cases where you're trying to seek reports, you can't help these kids. They're going to do what they're going to want to do. You know, those kinds of answers sometimes you get, which are obviously very clearly not true. And so there has to be a response in terms of the conversation that we have to have with each other on how to stop some of this behavior, because they are.
Man, I'm,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry.
I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead.
No, I was going to say I'm very disturbed that we marched. I was born in 1960. I'm 60 years old. I'm from a family of 14. I have six children myself, and between them we have 23 grandchildren, and I saw a lot of it. But I'm very disturbed that we marched and we asked for black people to come forth, and we asked to be in position. And now in Milwaukee, we have black people politically in very key positions, except our governor and our mayor, but most of them have black assistants. We have a black sheriff. We have a black county executive, this and that and the other. And those are my friends. Don't let me get it wrong. But we need them to move forward bad now. Now is the time. We need them to come forward. And I'm disappointed that there's not more being done, that there's not more being talked about. And I don't want to feel like I can't say it or I can't bring it up, that I can't say, hey, we lack because you will not attack.
Right, right, right. I hear you. Exactly right.
It hurts. It hurts.
Yeah, it does hurt. And like I said, very clearly, we know that it has to take more than just talking to as well. You've got to make some contributions in terms of, like you said, political figures, you know, their accesses to resources that we don't have at the grassroots level that have to come from that group. And when they fall to deaf ears, obviously it creates a challenge for us. I've got a brother that's online now who you probably know him. He is he's a former police officer, and he has been very active in pulling, going out and getting men to go into these specifically high crime zones and reach out to some brothers. That seems to be a tactic that sometimes works. I know on Thursday, we have one of our Black Reality Think Tank programs called Melanin Live, and we have a discussion that's going to take place with Brother Dennis Muhammad. Dr. Dennis Muhammad was one of the leaders of in the FOI out of Chicago, and he's in Los Angeles. He has an organization called the Peacekeepers, and they go out into the street, into the zone, the high crime zones, and reach out to those young brothers and make an attempt to bring them to the table. So I'm going to ask Brother Horace Kraft, who is also a part of one of our other programs called the Elders Council of Milwaukee, ask him to talk a little bit about his success in going out into the street. First of all, putting out the call to the brothers to come with him and walk through the communities where some of these problems were, and to kind of see what was the response from the community, the brothers, and what was the impact on that in terms of the young men that you were trying to reach out to. How you doing this afternoon, Brother Harvish?
Hey, all right, Baba. And Mr. Ellis, it's just extraordinary work that you're doing. This is, wow, amazing. Are you hearing me okay?
Yeah, I hear you very well. Very well.
Oh, okay. You know, one of the things, I've been mentored by so many people, and I know Brother Baba Courtney has came out with me. We went out to the Sherman Park community area. That's where I grew up. And we reached out to some kids there, and what we were trying to do there was show people how they could engage without the violence and so forth. And we went out there to do mentoring for the boys. We wanted to hit the youth first, and we went from the ages. We started at, say, from 14 on up. We didn't really exclude anybody, but we did have a couple other brothers to deal with some of the younger kids if that happened to be the case and so forth and this and that. But I know with the violence that's going on and so forth, and I wanted to give them some other options and some thoughts in regards to how they need to take care of themselves. And we started off by just doing some fitness activities. And we would talk to the kids, and it ranged from – we went there for like about 5 weeks, and then once the weather changed, you know, that stopped. But we engaged with some of the kids, and some were adults, some were, you know, 14 to 20, and, you know, and we started talking to them and then just kind of passing out some literature and engaging with them. And so it was positive, but like I said, we just didn't have the numbers with COVID hit and everything. That just changed a lot of what we were trying to do. But outside of that, I teach the martial arts. I go into the schools, and I do things in the streets. I used to be down at the DA's office, but I try to deal with a lot of the sex trafficking issues and so forth. And maybe about 2 months ago, a young lady was telling me that she couldn't get out of her house because she had called the police on the situation where a young lady was being sex trafficked, and she was scared to leave because she felt they were going to get her. And so I left and I helped her get out of the house. But it's just some crazy situations that's right, going on. And, you know, just doesn't seem to be getting any better. But we just need more people to come out there. And I try as I can, but it is dangerous. So I really don't want a lot of people that's involved that might not have a certain background. So I do have a lot of law enforcement people that are retired that assist me and so forth. So it's just difficult at times, but we try to help as many people as we can.
What kind of response do you get from the young people? Give me both good and bad.
Well, I tell you, we were going to Nova and with Brother Alfonso.
Yes. Okay.
And we were going to Nova and Asada, and we went to those schools for several weeks, and we also had 414 for Life. So we had a number of different groups that were there at different times.
Okay.
And we had some kids that were receiving us pretty well, because you know, and there were some kids that were just fighting every issue. But we also found that those kids had some crises that they were dealing with. I mean, like, for example, Nova, that school stayed open until about 8 o'clock at night from Monday through Friday. And a lot of those kids, they wouldn't go to class, but they would stay up at that school for, you know, until about 8 o'clock. And then when they would leave, they might sleep in somebody's garage or an abandoned car or something like that.
So they were homeless.
And so those kids had some difficult situations and stuff like that. And the school, they knew that, and they did so many things to try to get these kids in school and give them a safe place. But there were several kids that graduated, and we were able to, you know, build a relationship with them. As a matter of fact, we started a martial arts program after school. And we got the kids wanting to, you know, be in better condition and so forth. And they started even dressing better and attending class. And so there were a number of positive things that happened with some of the kids and so forth. And just how their esteem as far as how they felt about themselves, you know, got better and stuff like that. And with some of the kids, we ended up losing one kid. There was a young lady that was involved in a shooting incident. And she passed, you know, in a situation where, you know, she had a boyfriend that was abusive to her, and, you know, and they tried to run some kind of game. She ended up getting shot in a situation. And that was about a year and a half ago. And so, and I think at that in that school, inside of 4 years, I think they've lost maybe about two or three students under those kind of circumstances.
Okay, okay.
You know, through gun violence.
Okay. Andre, have you lost any of your young men through gun violence?
Yes. Can you hear me again? You can hear me, right?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay. Oh, wow. Yeah. We've lost probably 12. In fact, within the 8-year period, and as recent as maybe a little over a month ago, and you're just a young man, because I'm also now the gardener at the Vail Phillips Juvenile Justice Center. So when the pandemic happens, when the pandemic stops, I'm going to be back out there growing food and working with the young men. And so there's a young man that came out, DeMarco Smith, and he was recently gunned down and shot a very, very bad. It was a very ugly shooting. We built the fruit orchard across the street from the garden. We have trees in there that are dedicated to the young men, or many of the young men that we lost to gun violence, but it's been about 12.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay.
That's heartbreaking.
You know, I want
and that's
to...
Interesting.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's interesting because the number 12 is the same amount of disciples that Jesus Christ had walking with him. And I just thought that was interesting as I just said that right now.
Right. I
guess. Right.
That's an army right there. That's enough to change the city. So we lost some stakeholders right there.
Well, what I'm going to do is going to take a break. We're at the top of the hour. And then we're going to come back and open up our lines to some of our other callers because I know that they also have worked with in the communities doing some of these kinds of things. But then think about it, both you, Brother Horace and Brother Andre. I want a profile, if you can, of a potential community killer who's out here doing that. And I'm asking that because obviously once you have that profile, you can have a sense of how you might be able to reach them because we need to reach them too. And so we don't we want to be able to in some way find an effort to do this. So think about that for me, and then when we come back, we'll talk about that and open up the lines for some of our other brothers and sisters here who are doing some great things. But you are listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. I'm the host, William Rogers, and we are here, as I said, every Tuesday evening from 7 to 9 Central, 8 to 10 Eastern. And we're talking with Brother Andre Lee Ellis, who is very clearly a dynamic brother who has run the program called We Got This. And he's proven track record that he does have it. He does have that. So let's take a quick break and we'll come right back.
What you're calling African history Negro history, or the missing pages of world history. Go study the history of your masters. Go study the history of the people who enslaved you and find out why they found it a necessity to remove an entire people from the respective commonplace.
Faces of the people he'd meet, or one he could recognize. Brother, where are you? They told me that you came this way. Brother, where are you? They said you came this way. Brothers, are we all? Yet it seems there are very few who will answer a brother's call. Brother, where are you? They told me that you came this way. Brother,
you are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
The great Oscar Brown Jr. raises the question, brother, where are you? He said you came this way. So that's the question we're asking tonight to our audience. Brothers, where are you? We got work to do. We need you to grab hands with us, and hands with our children and families, and work with us. And that's the question that we're talking about. Before we get back into our discussion, I just want to let you know that we have other programs on this network. The Time for an Awakening media lineup, which is a part of the timeforanawakening.com radio platform, which is also a part of the Black Talk Radio Network.com. You can go to our website at www.timeforanawakening.com. www.timeforanawakening.com. And we have, there's an archive section. You go into that, pull down the podcast portal, and any of the programs that have aired on this network, you can listen to some of, most of them, 24/7. And it's a wonderful opportunity to go back for things that you may not have heard or programs that you might have missed. Again, www.timeforanawakening.com. And pull down our programs. We also would like to ask you if you, many of you, as you know, we've been doing this for a while now. We, a lot of times, we do need some form of support, and we have been asking our audience and those of you who can, if you don't do no more than just donate a dollar to help us continue to pay for the airwaves and do the things that we have to do that has a cost factor here at the program. And if you are in a position to do that, I know these are some tough times, but I'll just put it out there anyway. The go to our Cash App. It's called $N, which is then Nirvana, NIRVANAINSTI. $NIRVANAINSTI. And do whatever you can do. We greatly appreciate it. We thank you. Many of you have done that, and it does help us continue to put this program on the air. We have other programs that we're going to talk about right now. On Monday, from 11 to 1 Eastern Time, and all of these are Eastern Times, there's a program called African Perspectives. African Perspectives with the host, Brother Oshie. African Perspectives, host Brother Oshie. Mondays from 11 to 1. And then on Mondays from 6 to 8 Eastern, Acres of Diamonds with host Brother Jihad Ahmed, Acres of Diamonds. Then from 8 to 9 Eastern Time, Black Therapy Central. Black Therapy Central, which is hosted by Dr. Mawaya Cambone and Sister Nataki Cambone every Monday evening from 8 to 9. And then on the first and third Mondays of each month, Conversations on Reparations from 9 to 10. Conversations on Reparations, which is produced by the NCOBRA organization. And then on Tuesday, as you know, the Black Reality Think Tank. And then on Wednesday, from 11 to 1, Brother Oshie again, African Perspectives, 11 to 1 on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, we have a new program, which is a part of the Black Reality Think Tank radio network programs. Is called Melanin Live. Melanin Live. And the host is Chief Lance Jones. That program airs from 7 to 9 every Thursday. This Thursday evening, this guest will be Captain Dennis Muhammad of the Nation of Islam, who has an organization called Peacekeepers, a very powerful group. They have been doing some great work down in New Orleans, very similar to some of the things that you heard Brother Andre talk about today and others. But that program will be on this Thursday from 7 to 8, Melanin Live with host Chief Lance Jones. And then on Friday from 11 to 1 again, Brother Oshie, African Perspectives. On Friday from 11 to 1 p.m., African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. And then from 8 to 10 Eastern Time, Time for an Awakening, which is the broadcast by the developers of this platform, Brother Elliot Booker and his co-host, Brother Richard. And they be on every Friday. And then on Saturdays, from 4 to 6 Eastern, we have a program called Black Sister Talk, where you can breathe. The host is LaWanda Chambers. Every Saturday from 4 to 6 Eastern, Black Sister Talk, where you can breathe. The host is LaWanda Chambers. And then from 7 to 9, we have the Elders of Sankofa. And the host is many of the elders of the program. One of the guests, one of the people that's on tonight, Brother Horace Kraft, has done a fabulous job of hosting programs. He's got one coming up where he's going to be talking with a group of retired police officers about things on the streets and some of the things that we're talking about. So that's the Elders of Sankofa on 7 to 9 every Saturday evening. And then on Sunday, Time for an Awakening again from 7 to 9 with Brother Richard and Brother Elliot. So that is our lineup. That is the timeforanawakening.com network system, part of the Black Talk Radio Network, and the Black Reality Think Tank is so happy to be a part of this. So again, we ask you, if you can, to help us out just a little bit. Again, $ Nirvana Insti, capital NIRVANAINSTI. Anything that you do would be greatly appreciated. Okay, so we should get back into this conversation. Okay, Brother Horace, you were the police officer, and then I'll go to Brother Andre and ask him, give me a profile of the killer of the community. Who's doing this killing? Who are these guys?
Well, you know, the people that are lacking, and like what I have to kind of support what Brother Andre said when he said, if you don't have the supplies in the house, you know, that leads to the bloodshed on the streets. And so with lacking so many things, and the simple fact that we have this European way of thinking where we have money over people all day long. And so for that reason, you know, this is what people are seeking. The way I get money is to take it. You know, and because they lack the means and the support group, I mean, we aren't African-centered in our way of thinking and what we do for the most part, because that's just not how we came up. We came up here under them. So we don't have enough of that teaching for our young people coming up and so forth. But one of the things that I did when I was on the police department, and I worked in a predominantly white community. I was in the city of Cudahy.
Okay.
And so that was a city of about 20,000. And most of the crime were committed by white males.
Okay.
And when I say that, I'll say maybe about 70%. You had a small percentage of blacks because the numbers of blacks weren't there. So based on the numbers and the situations and so forth, I mean, that's how the crime, that's how it looked. We didn't have that many homicides for our population size. I think we might average one homicide every 2 to 3 years.
Right.
So the numbers were low, but, you know, but mostly the people that got in trouble most of the time were people that were usually people that were under the influence of drugs, things of that nature. Like I said, drugs have made a big difference in the way people think and their addiction to it and
right,
so forth
right,
and
right,
how they respond to just so many things.
Okay, you're right about that. Brother Andre, let me ask you, from your perspective, for instance, right now you're getting a lot of killings and shootings based on road rage. People are cutting folks off with their car, doing things, and then the person gets out of the car and shoots them. What's driving that behavior from your perspective of working with young people? And then what's behind that, you think? And I know as I read that piece by James Baldwin, he very elaborately talked about what's behind some of that. But what do you see on ground zero? You're at ground level zero. What do you see?
the access. We used to didn't have access to guns as they do now, Dr. Rogers.
Okay.
You know, but now someone, and that usually looks like someone outside of our community, can come on the block with a trunk full of guns and get all of the young men excited, and he can sell them guns to them very cheap, and they don't have to have permits and things like that to have those guns. And at the same time, he might have some drugs. Our young boys have gone from just smoking weed to doing crack, to doing lean, to doing heroin, to doing some severe drugs. They're using chemicals from within the house to make some very powerful drugs that alter their minds. Oftentimes it's embedded in them and it's generational. I had a young man told me, I said, man, why do you keep doing these things that are going to put you in jail? And he said to me, because that's the only way I'm going to meet my dad. And he said, my big brother's in jail. He's met my dad. My little brother's in jail. He's met my dad. And that young man is in jail right now. And his dad is out.
Wow.
So in the home, I'm telling you, I'm going to stress it. We have allowed outside influences to come into our neighborhoods and take away the pride of being a black man and growing up to be a prideful black man. You know, when I was younger, if a young man, if a buddy had a gun, you either was scared of him or he came and got everybody. But it wasn't where everybody had a gun. So if somebody got mad, there was a shootout. We didn't have access to cars. They used to have rules. You had to get a driver's license. You had to take a class and all of that. All of that's been stripped away. And we're teaching our kids to drive at 8, 9 years old. And we're letting them drive. And when they get 13, 14 years old, they're still in the car while you sleep. And they come out and they go through things, but a lot of them are hearing it. A lot of our rap music, and I'm an entertainer and I know it. I'm sorry that it sounds like I'm talking loud, but I'm very passionate about this. Lot of our rap music is supported by white rich white people, Jewish, other people that pay those rappers to say the things that they say, pop, 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 and make the gun sounds that get you excited. And a lot of times that make you speed up down the street. You also have, and you are a former police officer, we've been going back and forth with the forcing of the chasing. If the young men are driving fast and they're excited about doing it, some of the police officers are excited about chasing them, and they know how to make them crash, and they know how to make them burn in those cars and in their doing. And you also have driven the black man out of the house. You know, we started long ago with welfare and making sure that the black man wasn't in the house. We even gone so far as to making women think that another woman can help them raise a child, and so two women can do it. And boys are mad and angry about that, you know. And then you got stepdads coming into the house who have mental illness and drug problems and things like that, and they're not interested in the kid. They're only interested in the mama. But if the mama got a young daughter that looked like how mama used to look when he first met her, he might become attracted to her. Now the boy has to see him messing with his sister, and that causes some anger too. So a lot of times boys are in the streets because they're just not happy in the home. So the killer in our community is multiple. We have to get back to what brother Alfonso Watkins and yourself. You know, we had rites of passage. What happened to that?
Mm-hmm.
Brother Watkins needs to talk from the African perspective, and we need to make that a demand in our schools. But when he starts talking or he comes forward, you got black people that say, oh, here he come with that African stuff again.
Okay,
you know, I'm not African, I'm Glendale. I'm not African, I'm the hills. I'm not African, I'm downtown. I'm Third Ward. And we're craving to live next door to somebody that wants to burn a cross on our front lawn.
Right. Let me ask Brother Herbie White. How you doing tonight, Brother Herbie?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers, and to all of your guests.
Good, thank
you. And
it's
a wonderful conversation.
You're a pretty clear thinker. How would you theorize why this is being done like that? Why is it that we've got people running things who would want to create this kind of society?
Well, there's a saying, hurt people hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
Hurt people hurt people.
Hurt people.
Right. That's true.
Yeah. You know, if you, the things that the young people that's out here committing these crimes and hurting other people, if you walk backwards through their life, you'll find out why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah, a lot of pain. A lot of pain out here.
You're a lot right. of pain.
Yeah.
A lot of pain and no answers.
Mm-hmm.
Frustration. Hopelessness.
Yep, that's right.
Anger. Isolation. Inability to express themselves.
That's right. That's
people right. have talent. People have things that they want to do. Things that they want to create, but there's no opportunity. All their opportunities are stifled, and so that stuff is pushed back inside them until it explodes.
Right. Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah. Is there anything like that going on in Durham, to your knowledge? I mean, in terms of people trying to reach out, men getting out in the community and doing things. I mean, I know we got some areas out there that's rough.
Yeah, there's some. Brother Bruce can tell you more about, because he knows some of the people that's doing some work over in MacDougal Terrace. I met some people when he had his bookstore.
Yeah,
they was doing some, but I don't remember their names.
Yeah, he was online. He's hung up now. He's not online now. But yeah, I would like to know that. But I just thought maybe that would be interesting to look at that. But anyway, thank you so much, Brother White. I appreciate that, Brother Timothy. In Philadelphia, and you all got a whole lot of stuff going on in Philadelphia with those riots and all that. Yeah, is that what groups are out there trying to bring these young brothers together? Who's doing some of that outreach work in Philadelphia?
Brother, that's been talked about, and nobody's hardly doing anything, sir. The leadership is at zero. And I was talking about that with a few people. You know, we up to 500 murders in Philadelphia, man.
Wow.
500 murders. That's a lot of murders, man. And I had a group of people. We all sat down. We said, you know, if white people were killing each other like that, they would stop it. See? But it's not up to other people to come out of their race to help us. We got to help ourselves. And we have to learn how to love ourselves and know our history. It starts with that. The dysfunction in our family, lack of education, no jobs, the economy. And this pandemic
yes.
has hit us. Remember now,
yes.
see, when America has a cold, you know what I'm saying? We're suffering from a disease. So,
yeah,
so we're at the bottom of this.
Yep.
And we got to come together. Like I used to have a festival called the Children's Festival Dedication to the Parents, where the parents, mothers and fathers would come to the festival and the children would participate with the family. You also have conferences on education and discourse, where I had a Booker T. Washington Du Bois conference, and one conference on the 60s, one conference on the ladies of intelligence, Shirley Graham Du Bois, Dr. King's wife, things of that nature. And I would try to enlighten people as much as I could, suggesting books, had drill team, things of that nature. But we need those things in the community. But the thing is that communities are becoming more and more gentrified. So I'm telling you, we have to start an organization for youth. Wait a minute. When I say for youth, we all need to also start an organization for people with the illiteracy that are adults, the people that in Philadelphia that can't read and write
mm-hmm.
as adults.
Yeah, yeah, that literacy is real. That's true. I agree.
So that's where we're at now.
Yeah,
this is present time.
That's it. Thank you so much, Brother Harris. I know good and well. I know your work is trying to get police officers together and talk. I remember years ago they used to have the PAL, Police Athletic Association. Police officers would come together and work with the kids and provide another image than what we see a lot in the paper and the things that are going on now. Is that spirit gone now?
I don't think the spirit is gone with police officers that look like us. But in regards to the other police officers that create most of the problems for us, they've never had that spirit. They've done what they've done in order to, it was a program. Everything was planned to make them look good, to make them look righteous and so forth. But for the most part, that's just not what was going on. I mean, we had the PAL program. And I think my Mark Carter, actually Deidre Cole was part of that. She taught the martial arts to help the kids bring them together and learn how to protect themselves, the young ladies and young men. They have some other outreach programs. But right now everything is just different with all these movements. You know, police feel like they're being victimized because they don't want to have any accountability for their wrong.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people that are still doing things. Myself and a group of retired officers, and we belong to the Black Police, National Police Association. So we reach out, we go out in the community, and we meet with a lot of the community activists and try to help them navigate some situations and so forth, to do what we can on our end to explain how things operate in regards to what they need to especially during these protests. I mean, there's just certain things they should and shouldn't do, but at the same time, I'm not going to tell anybody that feels that they've their voices aren't being heard what not to do.
Right. Right.
And that's just being repeatedly done, not hearing their voices.
Yeah, I got you. And that's it. That is important. Brother Andre, what's the future looking like for you and your program? I know you've done evaluations of where you are and the successes that you've had and some of the things that you want to do better or do differently. So what is the future looking like? What kind of things are you, because of this COVID and all the things that are going on, how are you going to move forward in the midst of all of this?
Well, it's sort of like what Brother Horace just was talking about, too. It's alignment. We're beginning to align ourselves with groups like, the Running Rebels, for instance, that has a larger institution. And I don't think that they are as highly recognized in Milwaukee as they could be or should be. They've contributed a lot. For 40 years, they've been around doing the work that they do. But we have to stop tiptoeing around it, in order to get to the bottom of it, because what happens is if we don't get the young men out of prison or do some program where they have to come and do community service work, where at the end of the community service work, they're dying to get back to what they were doing, because once they're done, they're not literate enough to go out and say, hey, I want to start a business and things like that. And I think if we don't start to stop the competing that happens and start the completing that needs to happen.
Right.
We need to train our young people to complete and not to compete. And then I think what they'll do is lay the guns down a little bit and start coming together, teaching them how to communicate and talk with one another. I think history, our African and our African American history need to come, and especially if we want the future to be brighter, because I don't know, we've been trying to create a future. In fact, we are living in the future of what was our past, and it's gotten worse in some cases, in some ways. So I don't know what's been working. We need to take charge with people that are unafraid to be unapologetically African, African American, Black, or whatever we call ourselves, but to start demanding. Not only from the churches and the government, those places that we talked about, but from families, from fathers. If Black men don't go and get their children, we're not going to have a future. It's
that's
showing
right,
that. So right. Before I could even continue to talk about the future, Dr. Rogers, I have to say it's dealing with right now, because I can talk to a young Black man and I can say, hey, you can't go to that job interview. Hi. And he said, yes, I can. Yes, I can. You, even if they're checking my hair, there's a way to get around it, and I can do this here. And they've already figured out how to stay on the low. They figured out how to do it. So how do you get them where they want to become successful, where they want to have a future? How do you get young black men who don't think that they can or are supposed to live to be 25 or past 25 to know that they can? Because as long as we don't inspire or get them to do that, we're not going to have the future that we would like, because they're finding that college doesn't work. They're finding that the ways of the world. I know a lot of good mechanics, a lot of good carpenters. I know a lot of good salesmen and things like that who don't have the wherewithal to go to school. And so we got to find a way to allow them to create businesses right in their own homes. That's resources in the house. Mm-hmm. If they could get a license to fix the car in the garage, mm-hmm. and maybe they have to be held to a certain price that they can charge, because everybody already can't afford to go to the mechanic down the street that has a business set up that has to pay these high taxes to the government. They're already going to the alley mechanic who's fixing their car, and then sometimes there's problems because there's no way for them to be reimbursed. They can't write it off on their taxes and things like that. And we need politicians and people to start looking at that, especially if we're going to talk about having a future.
I agree. Yes, sir.
But Dr. Rogers.
Mm-hmm. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that, in the early 80s, I think it was about the mid 80s, they took out driver's ed. They took out.
Right.
They stopped with FIAD. All those activities. This is a result of all these activities and these arts programs that they took out of the schools. They knew what was going to happen, because now when you take driver's ed, now you have to outsource that. They don't do that at the schools. You're not using the cars that they had at the school for you to use and so forth and this and that. You have to pay $300 to $400. And some of the courses are more expensive and stuff like that. So that takes a lot of us out of the loop. But this is a result of people not knowing what to do by not having that experience in school and so forth. I mean, I recall seeing movies by – you know, what could happen if you drive too fast and so forth. I had all of that before when I had driver's ed, in school.
Yep.
Another thing that they also took out of schools was auto mechanics.
Right.
We used to be able to take our cars up there and fix them. So when Brother Ellis was talking about people having shops, garages, and so, yeah, they had a lot of that. And we had that because that's what we learned how to do in school. And now that you've taken that away, and now you're wondering why we didn't have issues like this with this reckless driving like this and so forth. And there's in the lack of engagement that we have, the type of engagement, because right now you have rules. When you go to school, there's no touching, there's no this. You have to sign this waiver. Every student has to sign this waiver, and they learn that in elementary school.
Right.
Every year they have to sign something, and they put restrictions on how you communicate with each other. So they put this barrier of fear that we have among each other. And then they promote the only way to protect yourself is to buy a weapon or call the police.
Right. That's exactly right.
And we've seen how that works and it doesn't work for us on so many levels.
I'm very clear.
Well, Brother Horace, if I can, Dr. Rogers, I live in a community where the police don't come. I live in a community where when you call 911, you're put on hold. You know, and I'm not sure if our zip code comes up. 53206 is known as the worst zip code in the world, where you can raise a black child, especially in America, they say. Well, they say in America, a black boy, highest incarceration, sex trafficking is very high, very large. And we're silent about speaking on these things. And who do you talk to about it? We have to become very real and very transparent in the reason why we do things. Organizations, everybody's trying to learn how to be a 501c3 to write the proposals, to get the budgets, to get the money, to do what with? Because if it's not buying clothes for the kids, if it's not helping to put food on the table, if it's not helping to get access to even just a doctor's appointment where you don't have to be embarrassed because the card that you pulls out make the white people in the office look at you, and you got to look at them and say, what you looking at me like that for? You know what I mean? So we have to come up with some real hardcore. We at a point where we're real hardcore, because if I was taught to drive a car fast, what's going to make me slow down? And if I learned how to do it without a driver's license, and my dad and my granddad has been driving without it for 30, 40 years, why do I think I need it? We've learned how to, we think we know how to talk to the police when they pull us over. And I try to promote, you need to be able to do drive in a way that the police don't pull you over. But if you've been, like I said, if you've been taught to drive fast, what's going to slow you down?
That's true. That's right. You know, and then another thing, and both Brother Harris, you and Andre can attest to this, there's a lot of surrounding circumstances. There's some other things that are surrounding us that are going on at the same time we're talking about this issue. Let me give you a case in point. I remember many years back when I was still teaching at the University of Wisconsin, I had one of my students to do a research. I had them to find out what zip codes that were in the city of Milwaukee, who had the largest number of liquor license in the city. And then once they found that, then let's look at the crime rate of that particular zip code and see what that looks like. And very clearly, Andre, when you said that, the highest liquor license in Milwaukee is the area down on Water Street, because obviously all those taverns and bars and clubs that are down there. But the other thing that we found out is 06 was second. And the number of liquor licenses that are granted in 06 was unbelievable. And obviously the crime rate goes right along with that. And the type of crimes.
Right.
A lot of domestic violence cases, robberies, burglaries, all of those were happening in that zip code and in those high zip codes. And then when the zip codes, their liquor license was low, the crime rate was low. So it's like a no-brainer almost to what motivates some of that and how it operates in that way. And somebody is not doing something.
And they're not talking about it. What you're talking about is what used to happen when you all found out about it. Why is anybody bringing that up? So right. Now when I say I'm from 53206, there's a label on me.
Right.
Right.
Wherever I'm at, even when I put it on a job application, they think, oh, this guy going to get angry and blow up the place. You know, at the same time, but yet a black officer can live in a white community and on his job can kill three or four people, and you have to decide whether he should be on the force or not, whether he has mental illness, whether he needs diversity training, and I say the whole force may need it. You know, we have to look at a fire and police commission. I may get in trouble for having this conversation
but we have to look at it,
and then nobody's going to come stand with me or be on my side about it. But if I don't die for something, then I'm living for nothing.
Right.
You know,
right.
So you have to deal with a fire and police commission that fires a police chief that they're calling unjust. And they didn't even know that he could come back and countersue them for something. And I'm thinking, aren't this the committee that's supposed to be smart enough to have already knew these factors? And we couldn't come back and do this? How can they make just decisions for society when they can't even handle that?
That's right. That's
so
exactly
some of it is who we have in position representing us. Just because they look like us don't mean they're handling us.
Amen. Brother Timothy.
Oh, definitely. Definitely true.
Brother Timothy?
Yes. Brother Horace.
Yes.
Yes, I'm going to say to you, brother, I like what you're doing with the martial art. As a matter of fact, the school I belong to, Taekwondo Chamu Kwan, under Grandmaster Ozzie Wright. We leave Philadelphia. We can't do it now. Matter of fact, I'll be in class tonight. But because of what's going on with the pandemic, I'm here talking to you on the phone. We go to the Harlem Zone. We travel. And, you know, during Black History Month, they do reports. They have home ec. Now, our martial arts school is bigger than martial arts school. We have a place where it is a home within a home. We got to learn to provide that with everything we have. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we raise money for scholarships. You know, we compete with other schools. We compete all over the country. But we have what you would want. We have tutoring. We have anything you have in the martial arts school. We got to do this. We have to be functional on all levels. Whether we teach somebody mechanics, while we teach somebody how to box, whether we teach somebody how to read, whether we teach somebody how to drive a car, we have to be self-contained like we once were in our communities, a long time ago. But we could go nowhere else, but only our communities. We got to have our communities to be suitable for ourselves, whether it's political, social, economic. That's what we got to do. Nobody's going to do that for us but us.
Right. Real talk.
That's Dr. True. Rogers.
Yes, go right ahead.
Dr. Rogers.
Yes, sir.
You remember in Hillside, the students used to build houses.
Yes.
That's true. They sure did, and they built one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they did. And so there were ways of getting our young people focused on other areas, you know. And, I mean, there have been attempts, I think, at one point. What was the name of the program, Andre, that MPS had put in operation that after school was over, they had these centers? What was the name of that?
That was the satellite program.
Yeah, okay, right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Are you talking about the CLC programs?
Exactly. That's it.
They were done through the Boys and Girls Clubs, and they were able to do these after-school programs in the centers, and they're finding that they aren't very successful in working for the kids either, too, now.
Right, exactly, exactly right. And those the kids got lunch, a snack, evening snack during that time, because I know I was with the OIC program, and we were going up there doing some work with those kids, you know, homework assignments. That was a grant that the Beta Foundation gave to MPS called Homework First. You remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, and so that wasn't some initiative. And so I guess the question is, what happened? I mean, what stopped that? What was the momentum that stopped all of that and said, no, we're not going to do that no more. We don't want to do that. What was going on, you think?
You know, I think when money runs out and certain people lose control of the movement, because I know when I graduated from high school, before I was graduated from high school, I worked with the Project Respect program, and that was with Michael McGee and Doris Green, Michael McGee Sr. And so they had that program, and then they also had AFY with Roy C. Hill. So you had these programs where they worked with people as they were in school. So I think I was a sophomore, a freshman, when I was involved with AFY. But I know that they did the Little League football. And I mean, it was just so many programs that they had available. And they still have a lot of these programs now. But like I said, funding goes back and forth. But you do have a lot of people out there doing it. But that's just something that's just not advertised as much. And that was one of the things that we were doing when we were going to these schools and so forth. We were showing up, getting so that we were let these kids see a crowd at their games or even at these karate tournaments and so forth. I mean, we've had tournaments where we've had more participants than we had spectators. So, you know, trying to get that engagement and people to see what's going on, something positive for the kids, that was a difficult thing.
One of our listeners just emailed me and said that the Chambers of Commerce put things in motion to stop that programs, to halt those programs do it. I'm going to let Brother Griffin. Brother Griffin, why don't you come on and tell us what you know in terms of your research. You can open up whatever line there was that you were on. I'm not sure which one you want to talk from. How about doing that?
Okay, can you hear me, Dr. Rogers?
Yes, I can, sir. Yes, I can.
Okay, look, I won't get too much into it, but I'll go back and try to dig it up. You know, I'm a single father, so I'll try to speed it up and not waste your time. In the late 70s, I was out west, and I spent time around people that were working primarily in Tucson, which happens to be a kind of a think tank for major corporations all over this country, because it has the proper demographics for how the whole nation runs. In other words, to give you an idea, Procter & Gamble and all those people, they used to test all of their products there first before they rolled them out across the country, because right. It was like a petri dish. I can tell you, Chambers of Commerce, if you even look at the Powell memo, all of that stuff is tied into it. They broke down the systems because the people in the building trades were saying that you were usurping the power and the labor by putting out these, a mass amount of people coming primarily out of urban centers that had building trades, and you were driving up the cost of labor. Mm. Now, it's hard to go back and track these things now, but I'm telling you what I know from a brother that's now departed named Eric Rice, that happened to be from Baltimore at the time, but was working for the city councilman in Tucson, Arizona. So I heard these talks all through the mid-70s and the early 80s, because I was part of a missile combat crew in the U.S. Air Force. And I'm going to say this again. When I hear these professionals and the people that are working in that community, number one, I don't blame the black community for what I know has been externally put on us. What I do have a problem with, and I learned this as a single dad, and I put a note in your thing to tell you. If you want to save these people, stop trying to get them at 14, 15, 16 years old. The best thing for us to do, and I tried to do it when I was a single father, go into these elementary schools, take over your PTAs, mm-hmm. stop letting people send your kids with the zero tolerance stuff. No such thing as self-defense, even when they're attacked.
Right.
But then 80% of the major, the people teaching them, are white females who do what? Mm-hmm. The same people that control the education and the Lost Cause movement that have this nation treating traitors as patriots. Let me tell you something. Right. If you do not force these people to teach your children in elementary school, you're not going to stop this. People talk about police officers. I don't disparage the trade, but you can't tell me a school resource officer trained in criminal and as a police officer is going to follow the edicts that everything that's done to a minor stays sealed until they become an adult. I can tell you right now in York County, Virginia, I had personal experience with my child where I had to call a judge in court for allowing a former school resource officer who then came out of retirement as a bailiff to get on the witness stand and testify against several young people that he hadn't seen in three or 4 years. We got to stop leaving these loopholes. And I'm going to tell you this. This is where I got into it. I did it when my child was in school. But I can tell you right now, as a layperson, if you don't stop these women from going to PTA meetings, turning your children into salesmen for goddamn Katy Diggs, pardon my French, and booster club members, instead of holding them accountable for teaching your children to do just what you keep talking about earlier. Each of you touched on it. If you've got a person that's illiterate and cannot decode English language for themselves, you have a walking dupe, period. I'll stop right there.
Right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Thank you so much, Brother Griffin, so much. Sister Yan, how you doing tonight? You've got an interesting program coming up that you're going to be co-hosting about getting brothers to the table to work in the community. How you doing this evening?
I'm doing okay. How are you? And greetings to everybody.
Great. Greetings.
So, yes, program is tomorrow, Thursday, what is it, from 7 till 9?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you, I said I was going to just listen to the brothers tonight because it just sounded real, you know, I just want to hear our brothers. That's what I'll say it that way.
Yeah.
And I'm also sleepy, but I'm hearing a level of reality that I'm hungry for.
Mm-hmm.
The brothers are not trying to sugarcoat things,
okay.
Saying that it's going to get better. We just have to, you know, pray and have hope and all that stuff. I like the reality that I'm hearing. And so what I want to say is that it was either Dr. Welsing or the other brother that said, if you don't understand white supremacy, nothing else will make sense to you. What I'm hearing are the machinations of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. They have been hell-bent on getting rid of the black man by any means necessary, and that's what they have been successfully doing. And taking away all these programs and everything that I've heard, the planting guns, drugs in areas where people are in despair, they know exactly what they're doing. And so this is the result. I have seen us in North Carolina so many times, you know, organize and say we're going to do this and plan to do that, and then we fizzle out. And I've said this several times, and I was looking at why are we not able to do what we did in the during segregation, what we did in terms of taking care of our youth and working together as communities. Why are we not able to do that now? Why are we not able to do what we did in the 60s, which was to build a strong black nationalist movement where we did rely on ourselves? We were building a nation within a nation. And we're not able to do it because they've been successfully getting rid of us. And we're sticking our heads in the damn sand as if that's not happening. Our brothers are locked away in prisons, being killed off in front of our eyes. And so I've come to two conclusions. One is that we have to separate. You can't get an enemy who's trying to get rid of you to stop trying to get rid of you. Someone who's showing you clear disdain, knocking down everything you build, to all of a sudden decide to stop. There's nothing in that for him.
I got you.
So for me, and not just for me as an individual, this type of thinking, but for us, it's not going to happen here. And I believe that's a reality that we have to face, looking at some other options, because our babies are at stake now.
That's what it is. Yes. And that's our future.
And if we don't take care of our children, that's I don't believe future. In hell, but we're going to go to hell.
We don't have a future. Yeah, exactly right.
Yes. And then the last piece is that this term, racial battle fatigue, I think that's another part of what's happening with us.
Say it again. What did you say? Say that again.
Racial battle fatigue.
Okay. All right.
Okay. All right.
Yes. We have been fighting for centuries, decades, and we're getting tired.
Right.
And so I see a lot of us are getting our little feet in politics, thinking that somehow we're going to make them do the right thing. That's not going to happen. And but we're getting tired of fighting this enemy. And so a lot of people are saying, well, and I've heard it. If you can't beat them, join them. Mm. So then they're really going to mess our youth up if we do that. So we have to look at making some hard choices and doing something totally different, because this ain't working.
Yeah, because the hard choices, you're right. You're right about that. And we got to talk about it. A lot of times we don't want to talk about it. We're scared to talk about it.
So that's all I got.
Real talk.
That's right. Brother Horace and Brother Andre, let me ask you something. I know, and we really don't have enough time to get into it. Are you all following what the Milwaukee Journal is doing? I call it they're doing the Tom Sawyer thing of whitewashing that Miller Brewing situation that happened back here earlier. And they had a big, long article in one day last week. And I said, I call it, they were whitewashing it. And what they were trying to tell us is that the brother didn't have no problem with white folks. He was okay. That he, by fact, the day that he did what he did, he sat down and had lunch with him. Have you been following that, Brother Andre?
I have not been following that. I'm not. I can't comment on it.
Right. Yeah. Well, the question that you've been following it, Brother
Andre? I happen to hear. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. I mean, I knew something about that back when it happened. I had my stepmother used to work at Miller, and she used to have problems there.
of us, the people that run Miller are those people from South Africa.
South Africa,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, they've always had that mentality and that attitude. And there was a lady that came on WNOV the day that that happened. It was a white lady, and she told all of it. She even indicated that the guy that she shot, the Hispanic guy that he killed, was one of the guys that had had wrote the letter and so forth, and stole some of his equipment, some of his tools. And then they started saying Miller Strong, and they right away said that there was nothing racial about what was going on. And then later on, and as a matter of fact, Senator Taylor had made a comment about some of the things that was going on there, and they shut her out right away. They did not show the clip when she was talking. I happened to be out there, and she started talking, and she had got some information about some things, but they never showed that.
Right.
So everybody that had something to say said something positive. They didn't address that this guy was being bullied on the job and so forth. All
that.
They said is Miller Strong.
Right. Yep. That's true. And like I said, it was not enough time for us to discuss that. But that is worth looking at. And I heard Sister Ayan talking about those hard decisions, because that after a while, you keep this up, people snap. We see it all the time, you know, both black and white. They can't take it, you know. And so I think that's why we have to address this, and we have to address it in that way, and look at it in terms of being able to provide. Provide help and support, you know, for folks that, you know, are going through these traumatic kinds of conditions. So anyway, we're almost at the closing hour. Brother Andre, any closing words that you would like to add as it relates to getting men to the table to help in their communities? Any words, anything you'd like to
say? You know, I want to say thank you. I'm glad to have heard the voices of others around the country. I'm going to start looking forward to listening more.
Please
to
do.
The station.
Please.
And becoming more involved. But I just want to say to the men, to the brothers, I'm proud of this. I'm proud that there are a number of black men that I know that have been in prison for many years that are coming home, and they're doing very well with entrepreneurship. They may not be able to go to college and get degrees. Some of them have done that while they were incarcerated. But we need the black man here in Milwaukee to join the forces, not to support the white agenda, but to support or create an agenda for our community that we can follow, one that can help us build a future. And however, by any means necessary, we need to do that.
Right. Brother Harris, any closing words? You want to tell us about your program you got coming up?
Yeah. I'm going to be talking about crisis in policing. I think that's December 19th. And I have Pamela Holmes also. She's a former sergeant with the Milwaukee Police Department. And she's been she's also the president of the National Black Police Association here in Milwaukee. And so there's a lot of things that she went through, you know, being a black female. She pretty much stays in the loop as to a lot of things that's going on. So I'm looking forward to her shedding a lot of light on some things from a number of different perspectives. But, I'm just looking forward to that. And I just want to thank Andre Lee Ellis. He said some things that, you know, touched me. One of the things, it may not be your birth dad, but I can be your earth dad.
Okay.
And just that thought in itself just, you know, I know how that would make someone feel, and I've had those kind of relationships with people, so it's good for him to say that. And other brothers, I hope they have heard this program and take a page out of his book.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, brothers and sisters. We'll be back again next week, and I look forward to seeing you. Thank you again for your support, and back in the Black Reality Think Tank and the Time for an Awakening Network. Have a wonderful and productive week.
brown shade of my skin. Only adds color to my tears. Oh, yeah. That splash against the hollow of my bones. That rocks my soul. When I look back on the dreams of yesterday that I once knew, and I wonder why my dreams never come true. Somebody, 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 ooh, tell me, what can I do?